The committee will come to order. Mr. Houston, if you'd take a silent roll. I'd like to welcome everyone, return members from this committee and new members as well. We've got about as many new members as we've got return members, so it will be a learning experience. We've got a lot of ground to cover today and tomorrow, and hopefully we can get everyone's questions answered and get the presentations done on schedule. Leadership chose to expand this committee from 12 to 18 this year, and I think that's indicative of the job that we've got ahead of us. We need to make a projection of our income, our revenue. I would call your attention to page 2 of the handout, which describes the committee's mission. It specifically talks about fiscal years 09 and 10. However, we've asked presenters to give us some prognostication as to fiscal year 11 as well, because it will have some influence on what happens with one-time money, with our holdback money. Again, I would refer the committee to the packet and go through that if you have not. We're going to take a break at 3 o'clock, and we hope to be down at 5:15 today. In the interest of frugality, we have water available for the committee in the cooler outside, but no cookies or snacks. There is a snack machine in the basement should someone have an interest or a need. We'll convene tomorrow again at 8 o'clock. Representative Bayer will chair tomorrow's committee meeting. And we will go through our process. Then on Thursday the 15th, we'll hear the governor's recommendation, and we'll finalize our report to the legislature. I remind the committee that we are being webcast on Idaho Public Television, so please use your microphones and keep your comments appropriate to the television viewing audience. Again, I'd like to thank everyone for their time here and their commitment to this process. With that, I would turn the microphone over to my co-chairman for any opening remarks. Representative Bayer.
Thank you, Chairman Getty. Chairman Getty's basically covered all the working parameters around the committee. I just wanted to extend my gratitude and appreciation to all the committee members for stepping up. I know that this is a busy time of year as everyone's preparing for next week. And I would also like to extend appreciation to all of the presenters who have facilitated the schedule so nicely for us, and our staff, and Mr. Houston, who's put a lot of work into this and is why this goes so smoothly. So with that, welcome and thank you very much for your service.
Thank you. First of our presentations today is Mike Ferguson from the Division of Financial Management. I would caution the committee, Mr. Ferguson's here to talk about economic prognostication. He is not going to talk about the governor's budget. So please defer any questions in that regard until our meeting on the 15th. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Ferguson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for taking care of that observation for me. It saved me a little bit of time. I wish I could say it was a pleasure to be here before you today, but this isn't really a pleasant presentation that I'm going to give you. And I need to say up front that I don't enjoy giving this kind of a presentation one bit. What I'm going to be doing is walking through some slides in a PowerPoint, and then there's also a handout that I think has not been distributed yet, but will be, that I'll divert to midway through, and then back to the PowerPoint. You're going to hear a lot about very specific details about the economy. What I'm going to do is step back to a much higher level view of the economy, both in terms of current conditions as close to real-time data as we can get, as well as the forecast that we're currently operating with, the economic forecast. And I'm going to be presenting some information that goes back 30, 40, even 50 years, but I really want to concentrate on what's happened over the last year. I mean, one of the cute phrases I could use, I suppose, is, my, how things have changed in just 1 year. And that is true. And I need a mea culpa. I didn't see this coming. I knew over the past few years that we were dealing with a large real estate bubble, that it would have consequences in the real estate industry, in construction, that would in turn affect the larger economy. But what I didn't really see was the degree to which the masters of the universe, the folks who occupy the lofty towers in New York, were working overtime around their cauldrons, brewing up a toxic brew of derivatives that have essentially blown up the economy. Now, here we are. There's change happening literally on a monthly basis in terms of the data that we use, the things that we look at in DFM to try to get a handle on where the economy is and where it's going. I wish I could say that things have stabilized and that we're at a position of relative steadiness in terms of the economic outlook, but that's clearly not the case. And I think as I walk you through the slides that I'm about to present, you'll understand the point and see what I mean. What I'm going to start with are a series of maps that are produced by the Philadelphia Federal Reserve Bank. And the significance of this information is that the Philadelphia Bank puts together a series of coincident indexes for all 50 states. And these are done using a common set of data for each state. They're calibrated to the state's long-term growth in gross state product, which essentially provides both a reading on where a particular state is in relationship to its past and a valid comparison across states, so we can see how states are stacking up against one another. I know that there's probably some interest in how Idaho is doing in a comparative sense, and that in part is what this is about. Now, this is the data for November 2007. These come out toward the end of the following month, so this is what it would have looked like in late December of 2007 as we were heading into the legislative session. And I'm going to walk you through the next 12 months worth of these charts. This is December. This came out in late January, and if you can remember, there was a lot of turmoil happening both at the national level and within Idaho. We were basically preparing to update our economic and revenue forecast because of changes that were happening. What's interesting to note here is that in November, there were a few states showing red. And by the way, I needed a little explanation. This is not a political map, and you'll get the joke before it's over with. The red indicates a state that's declining. The blue indicates a state that's expanding. And you can see basically there were just a handful of states, Nevada, Michigan, Delaware, Minnesota, and Montana, that were in the decline mode as of the end of the year when the November data was reported. In late January, a few more states had gone into the red side, and Idaho was starting to flash some fairly potent danger signs. This was available at the end of January. The next reading was at the end of February. Overall, things looked as though they were improving, but Idaho was still showing a decline. In February, a few more states had joined the decline category. Idaho was still among them. In March, things were beginning to deteriorate further. April, now we can see the real onset of a broad economic downturn. This is May. In June and July, things looked like they were maybe moderating a little bit, but notice that in the area that we're in, the Northwest, every state around us was basically in decline. August, September, October, November. Now, it surprised me when I saw this one because they apparently had decided to change the growth color from blue to green. I guess there might have been some confusion over what it really represented. But in any event, the point is that there is widespread decline occurring across the country. Now, this just gives you some ranges, with the maroon being the deepest red and an indication of the greatest decline, over 1% in absolute terms, which on a quarterly basis, since this is a three-month change, would translate into a little over 4% on an annualized basis. So all the deep red states are declining at over a 4% rate. Now, this is the data specifically for Idaho, going back to 1979. And what's interesting about this is a zero line, so whenever the line is above the zero line, we're expanding, and below, we're contracting. And what you have here is a situation where the two downturns of the early 80s are reflected in a fairly steep drop-off. We had one long downturn in Idaho over that period. There was not a recession in the mid-80s, but we had a fairly significant downturn. I'll show you that in a minute. The early 90s was a national recession. We really didn't participate in it. This is the 2001 downturn and the impact on Idaho. And this is where we're at today. This is as of the end of November. Now, this index for all states is created using non-ag employment, the unemployment rate, average hours worked in manufacturing, and real wage and salary disbursement. So it's basically got a consistent set of inputs that define a broad measure of what's happening in near real time in the economy. Now, if you flip to the handout that I sent around.
That's coming around.
Delay.
And while we're passing this out, committee, I'd like to welcome Senator Fulcher. He was a last-minute replacement due to an announcement yesterday and had to rearrange his schedule on very short notice. Thank you.
Okay, on your handout, on the top sheet, you have essentially a hard copy version of this slide. And one thing I want to point out is that whenever the line drops below zero, the economy is contracting. And the peak of the dip is not the end of the downturn. This doesn't represent expansion. This is simply the steepest rate of decline. And the decline continues until the rate of change crosses zero. So interpreting this, the entire period during which this is under zero or negative is a period of decline. Now, if you flip over to the next sheet, you can see the value of the actual index. And it's not on the PowerPoint slide, but what you can see here is that in the early 80s, we had basically a peak to trough decline of 13.9% in this particular index. That was over a 41-month period. In the mid-80s, the downturn was 2.4% peak to trough, and that was over a 16-month period. In the 2001 downturn, we didn't participate in the 91, but in the 2001 downturn, we had a 0.6% decline over an 8-month period. In the current episode, we peaked in December. We've been declining since, and the magnitude of the downturn so far in absolute percentage terms is 5.3%. Now, if you go back to the first page, what you'll see is we're still in the mode of descending. We've had about 3 months where we've been in around the 8 to 8.5% range at an annualized rate of decline. This is probably not going to get back to positive territory for some time. And in the meantime, as long as this is below zero, we're going to see that percentage decline continue to grow, hopefully at a lower rate. Hopefully this will stabilize and start to show a lower rate of descent than we're currently experiencing. But that is the best information that we have at present. Now, back to the handout, if you look at the third page, there's a list of states, and this is the month since peak. They're alphabetic. You can see that Idaho is 11 months in. That's November relative to last December when we peaked. For the U.S., there is an index for the U.S. It's 5 months in. A couple of standouts here. one being Michigan, it's been 103 months since they peaked. And if you flip the page and look at the reverse side of this, this is the same set of states in alphabetic order. Now what we're showing is the percentage decline since the peak. And if you look at Idaho, you can see that it's minus 5.3. That's basically the number that I've already reported to you. Michigan's down 15%. One thing that's kind of interesting is in September, we were third from the bottom on this scale. Only Michigan and Rhode Island had seen a sharper decline from their peak to where they were in September. In the last couple of months, there have been a number of states that have seen their rate of descent accelerate. And in particular, both Oregon and Washington have seen a pretty dramatic reversal of fortune over the past couple of months. And that's put both Oregon and Washington ahead of us. And if you flip this over yet one more time to the last page of the handout, you can see the most recent reading for November, the three-month change at an annualized rate. You can see that Idaho is at a minus 8.4. That's those 3 points on that time series chart that are the last 3 months, September, October, November, are in that range. And in the last couple of months, Oregon and Washington, as I indicated, have gone into pretty steep descent. Oregon down 19.2% on a three-month basis. That's a three-month moving average. It basically is intended to smooth the data. So essentially, what this paints is a picture of Idaho having broken from its position of the past couple of decades of consistently outperforming the nation. We have actually been leading in terms of going into this downturn. Now back to the PowerPoint presentation. Got a couple of charts now that show.
Would you entertain a question at this point, Mr. Ferguson?
Mr. Chairman, it's entirely your call. I'd be happy to.
And Representative Hill, I would remind the committee we are on kind of a tight frame, so unless the question can wait until the end of the presentation, I would appreciate that you refrain. Senator Hill.
Mr. Chairman, I understand that. I think it's a perfect question, at least for me, but I'm not sure I understand the basis that you're using for these graphs. A coincident index, are we talking about a decrease in the rate of growth? I think we're talking about a decrease in the rate of growth, not an actual decrease in revenues or a decrease in production or something like that. Would you explain that so that since all these graphs pertain to that?
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to address that. If you look at the second sheet of the handout, that is a graph showing the index itself. And this index is set arbitrarily to July of 1992 is equal to 100. This index is derived from the four economic variables that I mentioned, and then it is calibrated to match both the slope of long-term gross state product and the variability of gross state product in order to get a proxy for gross state product that's available at a higher frequency. Gross state product is only available at an annual frequency for states. What we have here is monthly values that are meant to be as close as we can get to reflecting what is actually happening in the economy in terms of output. So if you look at the end of this, the hook where we see the downturn, that means that the level of economic activity has declined. That's the index. If you go to the first page, we're looking at what in the jargon is a first derivative. It's the rate of change in the index. So this is the rate of change on a three-month basis in that index that's on the back side of the sheet. And whenever this goes below the red zero line, it means that the index is declining. And that would be consistent with, if you look at the index, it starts declining in January. It's hard to tell, but it starts declining in January of 2008. And that's reflected on the three-month change chart as well. Does that clear up the issue in terms of understanding this?
Thanks, Senator. Thank you. Senator LaFever.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry, this is quick. Mr. Ferguson, I guess my question is, if we were one of the states with the highest rate of positive growth, wouldn't that affect how big our number would be in that in these charts?
Mr. Ferguson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative LaFever, the way that would affect this is the value of the index would be going up at a steeper rate, so the slope of the index line would be steeper, and if you look at the first derivative, the change, that would put us up in higher territory during the period when we're experiencing that strong growth. And I have some other charts that I'll show you of actual economic data that will help show the degree to which Idaho has exceeded the performance of the nation as a whole in most other states.
Very good. Please proceed.
Okay, what I'm going to show you right now is one of the key components. This is the unemployment rate by state. And in January, our unemployment rate was 2.8%. Our rank was third in the nation. We were only beat by South Dakota and Wyoming with lower rates. The U.S. rate was 4.9%, almost a little over 2 percentage points higher. Most recent data is for November, and what this shows is that our rate has gone up to 5.7%, so we've basically seen a doubling of the unemployment rate in Idaho, although we're still a percentage point below the U.S. rate, and our rank is still fairly good at 18. Now, this is unemployment over time for Idaho, the red line, and the U.S., the blue line. It goes back to 1990. It's monthly data. And what you can see here is that Idaho has tended to be more stable than the U.S. over this period. We've had fluctuations, but not nearly as much as the nation as a whole. And in the past several years, we've dropped considerably below the U.S. rate. We were down for about three quarters of 2007, we were at 2.7%. And what we have seen since the beginning of the year is a very dramatic increase in the unemployment rate in Idaho. Even though we're a full percentage point below the U.S., we have seen a very steep rise, much steeper than the nation as a whole. Now I'm going to show you the same time frame for total non-farm employment. Very broad aggregate measure of employment. At the beginning of the year in January, we were ranked 21st in the nation. The U.S. growth rate was 0.7%. Ours was 0.9, about the same as Oregon, but basically and considerably better than Nevada, but below the other surrounding states. So that's how we started the year. In November, our year-over-year change was negative 2.7%. That gave us a rank of 47th. The nation was down 1.4%. We've basically seen a pretty dramatic deterioration in our employment growth over the course of the year. Now, here's a chart that is similar to the one for the unemployment rate. This is year-over-year percent change in non-farm employment. And what it shows is that Idaho, from the beginning of this decade, has consistently outperformed the nation as a whole until roughly the beginning of this year, at which time, we reached a peak in terms of growth of approximately 5% in the early part of 2006. And we've seen a deceleration going on since then, and recently it has accelerated and went negative, slightly negative, in May of this year and is now down 2.7% relative to November of 2007. So we've seen a bit of a reversal in terms of our relative position. Now this is the same information except on a month-to-month change at an annualized rate. You can see this is a lot noisier and the month-to-month fluctuations are fairly considerable. But again, it shows a similar situation It shows that we were seeing some negative growth in the period of 2001, and then again in 2003. If you recall, there were some layoffs that were happening back then. But in that period, we never actually had annualized growth that was negative during that period. In the current episode, we're basically seeing in the last few months some pretty sharp declines in the month-to-month change in non-farm employment. Okay, now I'm going to show you, now these are all historical data, most current available. I'm going to show you some national data that I think is of interest to the issues at hand. This goes back to the 50s and is basically the personal savings rate for the United States. And you can see that for a considerable portion of this period, up until the early 90s, we were typically running in the range of 7 or 8 to 9 or 10%, and in the 90s we've seen the savings rate drop dramatically. That's of course received a lot of attention. It's gone negative in recent years. Interestingly, this spike to 5% occurred in May of 2008. That I suspect has a little something to do with the stimulus package that was enacted in the early part of the year and why it's being deemed as being not entirely successful. A lot of that was saved. People on a personal level are going to do what's best for them as opposed to maybe what's best for the nation as a whole. We've seen a little bit of an increase in the past couple of months up to about 2.8%, but as people straighten out their personal finances, we can expect the savings rate to increase, and that will obviously put a damper on consumption activity. This is another household indicator. This is debt service as a percent of disposable income. It includes mortgage debt and basically goes back to 1980. And you can see that, again, during the 90s, there was a very steep run-up to from a range of 11 to 12% to over 14%. There was, and this is quarterly data, there was a drop in the second quarter to below 14. It now has shot back up to just a hair above 14. We might see this go up as mortgage interest rates on variable rate mortgages reset and the burden for carrying debt goes up in that regard. This is net state and local government saving, which is basically the deficit when it's below zero. This is the bottom reached in the 2002 episode, and I need to emphasize, this is national data. This was about minus $62 billion. As of the second quarter, and this was the data current up until November, the second quarter of this year was deeper than the amount of deficit nominally in 2002 by a few billion dollars. The third quarter data came out, and we're now at $103.6 billion. If you notice, this trough occurred after the 2001 downturn. This is where we're at now. This is, I think, an indication of the magnitude of the problem that is facing state and local governments. Now, this is data that you may or may not be familiar with. It's received a lot of coverage. I didn't used to pay much attention to this because I'm not a financial economist. I don't really deal typically in this world. I've been sort of forced into it by events. But this is the so-called TED spread, and it's basically the difference between the three-month LIBOR, London Interbank Offering Rate in Euro dollars, minus the three-month Treasury bill rate. And it's an indicator of the degree of risk in interbank lending. Treasuries are deemed to be essentially risk-free securities. Historically, the TED spread ranges in the area of a quarter to a half a percent. This starts in 2006. And you can see that it basically was in there, in that range, until the early part of 2007, and in June it spiked to about 0.75%. This is when rumors surfaced of Bear Stearns hedge funds being at risk. Then actions were taken. There were attempts to assure the market, stabilize things, And in August, a French bank lost some hedge funds, and the TED spread spiked again. And at this point, I'd say policymakers realized that we were in a full-fledged credit crisis mode. Now, this takes it to the beginning of this year. By the way, at the end of 2007, there were things happening like, for example, a run on public securities, the funds of public accounts in Florida. I mean, there were a lot of unusual things happening. At the beginning of this year, we had some problems with the stock market. There was a change in our economic forecast. I'll talk about that in a minute. But basically, things didn't settle back down, but we went through the first roughly two-thirds of the year with things seemingly under control. This takes it to the end of August. This is what happened in September. This line demarked September and October. The TED spread went into completely uncharted territory. I suspect this is part of what Ben Bernanke and Henry Paulson were talking to the legislative leadership about when Bernanke basically said, if you don't do this, what we're asking for, there won't be an economy Monday morning. This was suggesting some serious, serious problems in credit markets. This is the beginning of 2009. We've seen it come down to the range of about 1 1/3 percentage point. By historic standards, that would not be a good thing. By recent experience, it is a good thing. It's a good thing that it's starting to show signs of stabilizing, but it remains to be seen ultimately where it's headed. Okay, now I'm going to walk quickly through the last year's worth of economic forecasts, and in this instance for U.S. real GDP growth. A year ago, this is the forecast that we presented to you, and it basically had real GDP going to zero growth in the fourth quarter of 2007, and then a gradual recovery over 2008 and back to potential growth of approximately 3% out in 2009. This was the effect of the real estate bubble popping and the corrections related to construction and financial services industries and so forth. Now in February, those of you who were here will remember that we did something we've never done before, which is a new economic forecast and a new revenue forecast. And basically what had happened at the national level was our national forecast vendor, Global Insight, for the first time I believe ever they actually forecast a recession before it was officially declared. And what they indicated was a mild recession, 4/10 and 5/10 of a percentage point decline in the first two quarters of 2008. Stimulus spike back to very slow growth in the first quarter of 2009, then pretty quickly back to potential growth. This caused us to take $50 million out of the revenue forecast for FY 2007 and $70 million out of the forecast for FY 2009. And that was where things stood in terms of the executive forecast during the legislative session. Now in July, we were still looking at an estimated two quarters of GDP decline, but it had become steeper. The peak of the decline was in the fourth quarter of this year, minus 1.7% at an annualized rate, and about 1% in the first quarter of 2009. Then again, back to growth and back to potential. We updated our revenue forecast. That's our August forecast. That was the basis of the initial round of holdbacks. In October, we updated our economic forecast. We were now looking at a three-quarter decline, similar magnitude in terms of the peak drop, but clearly by then it was looking as though things were getting somewhat shaky. We didn't actually take any action at this point, but now I'm going to show you the November macro, the U.S. national forecast. We didn't produce a state forecast on this basis, but in 1 month, from October, and this was produced at the beginning of October, so it was after the meltdown that began in mid-September and continued into October, had already gotten underway, but the forecast didn't really capture the full extent. So this basically shows a 1.5% peak decline. In November, our forecast from Global Insight is now at a minus 3.3%, and it's a four-quarter decline. Basically a small decline in the third quarter, which is now a fact. It's an early estimate. The minus 3.3 in the fourth quarter, and then back to this return to potential out in 2010. So we now have an economic forecast that's the basis of the revenue forecast that you'll be seeing when the governor gives his presentation on Monday. Now, I'm not here to talk about that, obviously, but this is the December Global Insight macro forecast. This is what we're basing our Idaho economic forecasting and our revenue forecasting on. Still a four-quarter decline, but it's now at a minus 5% peak rate. Now, to put this into perspective, in this forecast, the peak to trough is estimated to be 2.5%. The 5% is an annualized rate, so it's really about 1.25 in terms of the absolute decline for that quarter. The control forecast has a 55% probability associated with it. That's a subjective assessment of what that forecast likelihood is. The optimistic forecast, characterized by Global Insight as a nasty recession, is a 5% probability, and that would have about a 1.3% peak-to-trough decline. The pessimistic outlook in this forecast, we always do three, the control, optimistic, and a pessimistic, is a 4.3% peak-to-trough decline in U.S. GDP, and basically has a 40% probability associated with it. We don't have a new forecast based on January, but Global Insight has released one, and it's still a four-quarter decline. The peak to trough is now 4.3%, and so it's basically become the pessimistic forecast. And that was basically released a few days ago at the beginning of this month. So that's the progression over the past year of the national economic outlook as expressed by real gross domestic product. This is the same series for Idaho and U.S. non-farm employment. And again, this goes back to January when we came before you last year. And what we were looking at was essentially in 2008 a decline in Idaho growth to below 2%. Now if you look at this chart, you can see back to 1980, and we had three consecutive years of negative employment growth in the early 80s. And I liken what happened in the early 80s to in Idaho to depression-like conditions. I mean, we had three consecutive years of decline. By the coincident indicator, we fell about 14%. For comparison, during the Depression in the 30s, the peak to trough decline was about 35% in GDP, and the unemployment rate hit about 25%. So it might be a bit of an exaggeration, but it was pretty miserable. I was here during that period, and it didn't feel good at all. But we basically had another mini high-tech downturn in the mid-80s that wasn't associated with a national downturn. We skipped the downturn of the early 90s, and in the recession that occurred in 2001, on an annualized basis, our growth hit zero, whereas the nation actually fell into negative growth. And as you recall, there was the jobless or job loss recovery, pretty sluggish performance in terms of employment growth in the initial period of the recovery. You can see that since 87, Idaho has outperformed the nation in terms of employment growth in all but 1 year, 1998, when we were both at 2.6%. Other than that, we've done better than the nation. And it was our expectation that while we would decelerate, we would see continued positive growth. In February, with the change national forecast. You can see that U.S. employment growth still stays positive, although barely so. We're down to below 1% in terms of Idaho growth in 2008 and a fairly sluggish recovery. That was the basis of that update in the, during the last legislative session that I already mentioned. In July, as I indicated, the national outlook worsened. We actually dropped our 2008 employment growth forecast into negative territory. This caught some folks by surprise, created a little bit of controversy when it was first released. But here's what's happened since. In our October forecast, we basically updated our 2008 estimate to minus 0.7%. and our 2009 to minus 1.4, and then growth out in fiscal 10, or I'm sorry, calendar year 10. This is where we're at now, and this is based on our January Idaho economic forecast, which is based in turn on the December 2008 Global Insight forecast, 0.9% this year, 2.1% next year. Puts it pretty much into the range of the first 2 years of the early 80s downturn. It would be the worst employment performance in the state since the beginning of the 80s and exceed what happened in the middle of the 80s when we had a kind of a mini high-tech recession. So now I'm going to shift to throw in a couple more years in and show you how our current forecast looks in terms of total non-farm employment out in the immediate years ahead. We've got basically two down years, very slight growth in 2010, and then picking up in 11 and 12. That's total non-farm. This is construction. Now, this is a little deceptive because in the recovery that began in the late 80s and lasted for a couple of decades, we saw some pretty strong growth in construction employment in terms of percentage rate. But this was coming off of very low levels, down in the 14,000 range in terms of the number of jobs. By the mid-90s, we had settled into a growth that was more similar to what was happening at the national level in terms of construction employment. But in the last several years, in basically the period 2004, 5, and 6, we saw construction get into stratospheric territory from very high levels and basically peaked at over 15% growth in 2006. We think it's going to have a couple of years of fairly steep decline. In 10, it'll still be negative, about 3.5%, and then we think it'll start picking up again in 11 and 12. Electronics manufacturing. Basically, this sector peaked in 2001. Now, bear in mind, this is growth, and this is a decline that occurred in the late 1990s. But the peak employment level was in 2001, and it was just shy of 20,000. We have, we're all aware of the declines that occurred in the aftermath of the 2001 downturn, basically 2 years of about 9% decline back-to-back. Pretty much flat after that, one positive year of a little under 3% growth. But basically, the last couple of years have been pretty miserable. We had layoffs at Micron in 2007, then again in 2008. We've got a couple of years of growth that are well into double digits, and then recovery out toward the tail end of the forecast horizon in 2012. And this is business services. This has been a strong source of growth in the state. What we're basically forecasting here is a couple of negative years, and this will be for the first time since the history begins, which is in the early 90s. There were some changes in data collection that render the data prior to 1991 incompatible, so we can't get back too far. We can do that with construction and a couple of things, but not with this sector. But basically, this is the forecast that we have for business and professional services, fairly muted over the forecast period. This is personal income. You can see that we underperformed the nation in the early part of the 80s. We basically picked up strongly in the 90s, and up through 2006, we've done quite well in comparison to the nation. What we're expecting is basically the growth to match that of the nation, and not going to negative territory, but dip below 2%, which will be, for Idaho, the worst performance since the beginning of the 80s. This is now in real terms, because in the early 80s we had some inflation that helped prop up the nominal figures. And what you can see is that in 82 we had a little over 1% decline. In the mid-80s, with that downturn, we had a slightly negative episode. And the forecast is for near zero, but still positive in the immediate period ahead. And I would remind you that the downturn in the beginning of the 80s was much harsher and yet yielded a fairly modest decline. The spike in 2009, this is because of a kind of an interesting phenomenon called deflation. Basically, for 2009, the forecast that we're using, the national forecast, has for the personal consumption price deflator, which this is, this series is deflated on personal income, it's minus 0.7%. The CPI, a different indicator of inflation, is forecast to decline 1.5% in 2009. So a brief period of deflation.
How are you doing on your presentation?
I'm done.
Oh, great. Questions to the committee? Seeing none, thank you for your gloomy but honest presentation. I'm sure we'll have more to come. Mr. Fick? Mr. Fick will be presenting from the Department of Labor. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Fick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just click here. Yeah, just click on there. Mr. Chairman, Chairman Baer, members of the committee, I'm Bob Fick. I work for the Idaho Department of Labor. I'm here on behalf of the director, Roger Mattson, who's at a workforce meeting, national workforce meeting. Mike's said a lot of what probably I was going to say. Obviously, we thought there was going to be a slowdown a year ago. We didn't think it was going to get this slow. We didn't think it would be a recession. Obviously, it is.
Can you speak more into the mic?
Yes, sir. Unemployment is mirroring what it did in the 2001 recession year, but non-farm jobs really started to decline dramatically, and Mike pointed that out. We've been dropping steadily since spring, and the worst is still to come. Jobs will continue falling for behind year earlier levels through 2009, or well into 2009, and the unemployment rate will continue to rise probably until late summer. The rate will probably exceed at some point 7% in 2009. Jobs will disappear probably to a point of 4% below year earlier levels early spring, and then possibly start a slow recovery in the late summer, early fall. The net result will be just a few hundred jobs more in mid-2010 than there were in mid-2008, and there will be this trough of jobs, to lost jobs in between. Last week was the first week of 2009 for us. The indications from the statistics we have for that, and for some for December, show that we're still a long way from the bottom. We expected unemployment benefits to increase. They always do in December, January, February, but they jumped 1.5 million. From the last week of 2008 to the first week of 2009. We haven't had a jump like that ever, I don't believe. I looked back and I couldn't find one. The total payout in regular unemployment state benefits in the last week, or the first week of 2009, the last week, was $9 million.
You might get that mic a little closer to you. You're being recorded on television as well.
When you add to the $9 million in regular state benefits, the $1.7 million in extended federal benefits, Idaho pumped about almost $11 million into rural communities in 1 week, this last week. That's money that struggling families are using to pay the rent and the mortgage. They're using it to pay buy food, pay utility bills, support the merchants. While it's not the same as a check for that you get for a job, it does provide some help in these times of significant economic stress, and there's no question that that's what the entire state faces right now. Obviously, this decline has been dramatic. It's been fast. A year ago, November 2007, Idaho had the lowest unemployment rate in the nation. There may be some question about the kind of jobs the economy was creating, but the evidence of unemployment or help wanted signs in every place you looked was clear that there was a job for anybody who wanted to work. By this past November, Idaho's unemployment rate had gone up three full percentage points. 18 states had lower rates, and the economy has begun to shed jobs at a serious rate. In the West, where Idaho had at one time had the lowest rate, four states, as this chart shows, four states have lower rates now, and five, mainly on the coast, have higher rates. The national rate has been climbing as well. Our unemployment rate, as Mike pointed out, still remains a point below the national rate. No other state has had a greater percentage increase in their unemployment rate from November 7 to November 8 in Idaho. It was more than double. And only two states, Rhode Island and North Carolina, had greater than the 3 percentage point increase that Idaho's had in that year's time. The national rate obviously has been going up as well, but the gap between the Idaho rate and the national rate has been narrowing. But for the problems that we do have in Idaho, we don't appear to face the same kind of severe circumstances that a lot of other states are facing. Even though our economy is continuing to deteriorate, it appears that we would probably still remain below, our rate will still remain below through this recession, the national rate, as it has for the last 7 years. Non-farm jobs, as Mike said, began disappearing in May. They were down a third of a point in May 2008 compared to May 2007. By November, they were down 3.1%. And as I said before, we expect that the year-over-year comparison of non-farm jobs will slip to 3.5% to 4% lower over the coming 6 to 8 months before it stabilizes and the slow recovery starts. By June of 2010, which is the end of the 2010 fiscal year, the economy will essentially have the same number of non-farm jobs that it had last July, and that's 728,000, which includes 65,000 self-employed. Non-farm jobs in fiscal 2009 will average about 0.1% below 2008, and 2010 will be only 0.05% higher than 2009. Those statistics, that performance could be affected if there's major public works jobs, like the Obama administration is talking about. What effect that has, we won't know until you actually see what happens. We did an analysis last summer in which we determined that for every $100 million spent on highway improvements, we create between 1,900 and 2,500 jobs. Depends on what kind of improvements they are and where they are, and whether there's land to be bought or not. The the recessions hit every part of the state. In November 2007, and this is a map of the state, the counties in Idaho for 2007, it shows the unemployment rates. The blue counties are counties with the rates of below 4. The cream color counties are counties with rates between 4 and 6. And those three dark red counties are counties with rates above 6%. In the past year, every county has seen its unemployment rate increase at least a full percentage point. 25 have seen the rate double. The highest rates have been in north and north central Idaho, where the mills have had severe problems. Also, east, west, and north of Ada County, where there's been where manufacturing has been hit fairly hard. This is November 2007. Blue's almost gone, and the dark red, which is over 6%, is approaching half the counties. Overall, from November 2007 to November 2008, Idaho lost 17,600 jobs and 19,500 fewer people were working. December's unemployment rate doesn't come out until Friday, but there's clear evidence that it's going to go up again. We've had three months in which we've seen half-point increases in the rate from the previous month. That's possible. No one knows what's going to happen on Friday, but it's possible that the rate could rise again significantly from 5.7%. One of the reasons is the number of new hires by Idaho employers in December was just 10,400. That's the worst December on record since 1998 when these statistics started to be kept. Even during the 2001 recession and its aftermath, new hires in December were 11,500 or higher. But this is also the second lowest new hire month ever. The only lower one was 9,500 in May of 1999. There were 26, as a reflection of that, 26,000 initial claims for unemployment in December. That's on top of 20,000 in November, almost 21,000. This was the first back-to-back 20,000-plus initial claims months we've ever had. The only other 20,000 initial claim month was in December 2002. During 2008, 140,000 workers applied for unemployment benefits. That's out of a workforce of 629,000. It's about 22% the ratio. It's awful high, but it doesn't approach the ratio of 2002, which was almost 30%, and the ratios in the 1980s were well over 40, and in 1982 it was 50%. Since the economy peaked in 2006, Idaho's lost 7,500 manufacturing jobs, 7,500 construction jobs, and 1,200 financial service jobs. That those losses ripple through the economy. So in the last year, we've lost 4,500 retail and wholesale jobs, 3,400 professional and business service jobs, 3,000 hotel and restaurant jobs, and 1,100 trucking and warehousing jobs. Job loss has been accelerating since spring, and it's obviously going to continue for at least the next 6 months and probably longer into the fall. Exports have been running at ran at a record pace the first 9 months of this year, or of last year, and that has probably helped to dampen some of the loss in manufacturing. But since our export sales continue to be driven primarily by high-tech products, and the global nature of the recession, we're probably going to see international markets cut back on those purchases until things start to turn around, and that will have a further effect on export-linked Idaho jobs. Taking into consideration the jobs that have been lost since the middle of 2008, the Idaho economy will end up in mid-2010 with about 884, if we get down to actually counting every job, 884 more jobs than we had last summer. On top of that anemic growth. It's 0.12%, I think, is what it comes out to. There's going to be a shift in the job mix. Manufacturing jobs will be down 5,200, construction jobs another 3,300, and financial services another 1,000. Replacing those are going to be 7,400 new jobs in healthcare and education, about 1,100 in professional business services, and slightly more modest growth in some of the other service sectors. So while there'll be a net gain in jobs by mid-2010, the value of those jobs is less. At a 2008 average wage for the jobs in these sectors, the job losses in construction, manufacturing, particularly the high-tech sector like Micron, and the financial services area will suck almost $600 million out of the Idaho economy annually. While the jobs that they'll be replacing those, mainly in healthcare and education, add in less than $400,000. So the net loss, payroll loss, using 2008 average wage numbers is over $200 million. excuse me. With the job mix shifting, the department continues to provide training for and educate resources for training and education for workers who need to either improve their skills or gain new skills so that they can grab the jobs that Idaho economy will be producing in the future. In the last 6 months, nearly 2,000 workers have participated in training programs provided by the department. Even though our main training program, the Workforce Investment Act, has seen the federal grant that supports it cut from over $15 million in 2002 to under $7 million today. All of this taken together is taking a toll on the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. Excuse me. Unemployment benefits have been running at record levels and will continue climbing over the next 6 months to a year, depending on... Well, thanks. Depending on whether there's any a significant effect on the public works program from either the state or the federal level. With claims running ahead of 2003 record, the past record in 2003, both in the number of claims and the amount paid. The trust fund is being drained. Benefit payouts exceeded $6 million beginning in December. That's a level we've never reached before. And they hit $7.5 million the last week of December, including the federal extended benefit payments. That weekly total was over $9 million. And then there's the $11 million that we talked about from last week alone. The unemployment rate has risen steadily since the fiscal year began from 4.1% to 5.7%. And it'll continue rising over the next two quarters, approaching, if not exceeding, 7% to average 5.7% in fiscal 2009. That would be the highest rate since 93. It will continue to rise through much of the last half of 2009, the first half of fiscal 10, and again near or above 7% before the economy finally bottoms out and begins a slow recovery. The average rate for fiscal year 2010 will be 6.8%. That's the highest rate since 1987. Oh, do I hit the wheel? Here we go. Aside from more than doubling in the past year as the economy has contracted, there's been a slightly higher unemployment benefit activity trade and from hotels and restaurants. That's part of the whole ripple effect when you see a manufacturing construction contract. The largest number of claimants, as the graph shows, is still in construction and manufacturing. There's just twice as many of them as there was a year ago. The fund, which stood at nearly $320 million in November of 2007, is now is down to $232.2 million at the end of November, this past November. That's what triggered a 70% increase in the rates, tax, the employer rates for unemployment insurance. The each rate category went up 70%. There are some employers that will see substantially higher rate increases because in addition to the rate category, the rates in each category going up, they probably have changed categories because claims against their accounts have increased, and that's pushed them into a higher tax bracket. The increase, this increase, however, in the tax rate, which we're now in the first quarter, we're collected on April 30th. We're going to raise about $50 million more than what we took into the fund a year ago in 2008. That's just one-sixth of the amount of money that employers have essentially saved by the changes that were made in the unemployment insurance program in 2005. And it's not enough to cover, still bring in the balance of the income into the fund with the payments that will go out. Based on current projections, and these were made before the $9 million regular payout a week ago, the fund will be drawn down to just $22 million, that's that lowest point on the chart, in the first quarter of 2010. And then the fund will begin to rebuild itself. The actual amount, the fact that it drops that low and that the tax increases are not keeping up with the precipitous decline in the economy means that there'll be another substantial tax increase in 2010, but we won't know the extent of it until next fall when we finally get the statistics in. Overall, the job situation will continue to decline. Unemployment will continue to rise before finding the bottom, hopefully sometime in late 2009. We hope that that's not the headline a year from now when we're back here talking about this. Be glad to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Fick. Senator LeFevre. So I do have one quick question. Our per capita income in the state of Idaho has normally been someplace between 46th and 48th. What's our, how rich is our work comp benefit, I mean our unemployment benefit?
Mr. Chairman, we have a, I wish I'd have brought this because we did this, we looked at this a while ago, and it may have been for you, I don't remember. We're in the top 15. As far as maximum weekly benefit, we're high as far as the number of unemployed people who actually collect benefits, are eligible to collect benefits. But the reason, as I understand it, not having been here in 1935 when it all started, but the reason that we're at this, the level that we're at is because of the cyclical seasonal nature of our workforce and the industries that we rely on, food processing, timber, those industries who are heavy users of the unemployment insurance fund. And the benefits are what keep the workers in place while during these seasonal shutdowns so that when they're ready to start back up again, the companies are ready to start back up again, they have the workers available to them. But we are relatively high.
If you have the opportunity, you might get that information together to share with this committee. Three questions. Mr. Chairman. Representative Roberts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bob, the question on one of your charts, you talk about the projected job losses and gains by sector, and then also the employment payroll of those same type of jobs. What basis do you use over the quarters? I think that's on your this chart here. What basis do you use to show the increase on wages, specifically in the education services and health care and social assistance?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Roberts, this chart simply does the math on one of the charts that we provided in your packet that shows job increases by sector projected through mid-2010, and then in the column on the other side of that, it'll show what the average annual wage is in 2008 for that sector. All I did was the math.
Mr. Chairman, follow up. Mr. Chairman, Bob, I guess I'd like to go over to that other chart then. If you talk about the increased jobs in both educational services, which this chart you referred to, what basis then do you use to substantiate additional almost 2,100 jobs in like educational services, both private and public, and 5,300 jobs in the healthcare and social assistance?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Roberts, the view of the department and its analysts is that because Idaho's population continues to grow, obviously not what it, at the rate it was in 2004 and 5 and 6, but still at one of the fastest rates in the nation, that healthcare and education will maintain a more normal growth pattern because they're people-driven. And that is the reason for what maybe Mike would suggest is a more optimistic view of employment in those sectors than others might have.
Mr. Chairman, one additional question. I know it's important to change subjects for a moment, but you talked at the closing of your presentation today about the 70% increase in unemployment insurance rates. That change was made by the director, I believe, more than a month ago, where we announced that change.
Right.
In light of the new numbers that may be coming out in claims, number of people that are unemployed, I guess what you're leading us up to is there could potentially be another increase in that rate sooner than later, depending on what happens on Friday.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Roberts, the rate can only be adjusted once a year. There will be no rate adjustment again until 2010. That's the way the law is written, and that's the way we've always, even before the law was rewritten, the rates, while different, set differently, we're still only adjusted once a year. And thus, consequently, there won't be any additional adjustment in 2009. The rate is what the rate is, and it will be the rate for all four quarters of 2009. There will, because of what happens with the fund, can't get that chart back because I don't know how to use the thing, but because of the way the fund's going to be depleted, there's no question that there will be another substantial rate increase in 2010. Because the fund can't go broke. If the fund goes broke, the state has to borrow from the feds, and then the employers not only pay back the loan to the feds, but they pay to the state fund to build the fund back up, so we don't need the loan anymore. And you have to maintain it. Choice that the businesses made in 2004 when the Committee of Interest in Unemployment Insurance, IACI, small independent businesses, retailers, all those people, labor as well, they decided that the level of the trust fund up to that point was too high. It was targeted in terms of 2005, the target level for the trust fund was $400 million. They believed then, and the legislature agreed, that that much of that money would be better off in the hands of businesses who could use it to expand and pay employees and the whole nine yards. So the target level of the fund in the new formula was essentially halved, and in 2005 terms, it was reduced to $200 million target level. Obviously, with the increase in the labor force that we've had in the last 4 years, the target level is much higher because covered wages are much higher. But because the balance in the fund was reduced so significantly, the formula to create revenue for the fund has to react more swiftly to economic change. And in the case of this economic change, it couldn't act even fast enough because so much of the change has come in the last quarter, and the formula essentially relies on the four quarters before the last quarter. So we're going to capture all of that, everything that's happened since October and over the next 6 to 9 months, which are going to be pretty bad. That'll all be captured in the calculation for 2010, and the rate will go up substantially.
Just one closing comment, Mr. Chairman. I'm concerned about the $22 million fund balance that's projected based on what we know today. If things get worse and we have a higher unemployment rate with more claims, that fund balance will then be exhausted. We may have to address it prior to that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Representative Roberts, I sat on the task force that made the recommendation to the director. I think the number I've heard over the last 3 years is we've saved business, or we kept over $300 million in business's pocket rather than putting it into a trust fund that at that point didn't need it. But the downside was it's much more reactive. The formula is much more reactive than it was. Mr. Fick, how many states are in the red in their trust funds now and have borrowed from the feds?
Mr. Chairman, I know South Carolina just finally got the governor to sign the approval to borrow. I think Michigan has borrowed. Ohio, if it hasn't borrowed already, is on the verge of borrowing. New York, I believe, is another one. I think California is. If it hasn't borrowed, it's going to have to borrow very quickly.
So there are a number of states that employers are going to be facing not only funding their state account, but paying back the federal loan.
Depending on how they've managed their fund, that would be correct, Mr. Chairman. The hope of the Department of Labor here in Idaho is that we are able, because of the reactive nature of the revenue formula, if we have to on that in the first quarter of 2010, borrow in what would amount to a bridge loan, where we would borrow enough money to get us through that low spot. The problem is that the revenue, we don't get the revenue until April 30th from the first quarter, and the revenue we get on January 30th from the fourth quarter is relatively small, because employers have, many employers have already met the maximum amount they pay tax on, and so they don't have to pay anymore. Anyway, what we'd hope is that we would get that loan and then use it as simply a bridge loan, and then repay it from the receipts we get in the first and second, from the first and second quarters, so that if we repay it by, I believe, December 1st, it's in the fall, I'm pretty sure it's December 1st, if we repay the loan to the federal government by that point, there's no interest, it's just a straight pay them back. And that's what the plan is right now, presuming that the severity of this downturn doesn't escalate beyond what we see even with last week.
Thank you. Further questions of the committee? Hearing none, thank you for the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We're 2 minutes ahead of schedule, but if Mr. Dietrich is ready, we'd love to have his presentation. Mr. Dietrich, welcome to committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Getty, Representative Bear, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Don Dietrich, Director of the Idaho Department of Commerce. I would like, before I start, to introduce our most recent addition to our executive staff, and that's Lane Packwood, who is running our Economic Development Division. So he's one that you'll probably all get to work with over time. As we all know, the economy this past year has been a roller coaster, and unfortunately, Idaho has not been immune to what is now officially recognized as a recession. The fallout from the financial crisis is becoming ever more severe and has led to less available credit for businesses and consumers. That has a direct impact on corporate relocation decisions. Lack of consumer confidence has trickled over into the business sector, creating what we call a decision freeze. Idaho will continue to trend in the direction of the national economy over the next 24 months, but without the extreme highs and lows of our competing states, many of whom have leveraged themselves with higher debt and riskier investments. However, there are a couple of bright spots. Some international markets are still experiencing significant growth opportunities. The weakness of the U.S. dollar has provided an opportunity for Idaho exporters to be more competitive in the global markets. In 2007, we had a record $4.7 billion worth of exports. As of September of 2008, we've had $3.9 billion, which is a 22% increase over the same period a year ago. So we are still on record pace. Idaho has fared better than many states as a result of our ability to diversify our economy over the past 3 years. Idaho has seen growth in energy-related companies, high technology firms, agriculture, and manufacturing and distribution. Unfortunately, commerce experienced a drop-off in the number of companies in our recruitment pipeline from 50 in 2008 to our present pipeline of 23. 30% of our deals in our pipeline continue to be international. Currently, 5 leads have passed the site selection phase and they're moving into the decision phase, and these 5 companies represent approximately 1,350 new potential jobs. To help Idaho weather these tough economic times, I'd like to share with you an overview of the Project 60 initiative. Project 60 is a comprehensive initiative to grow Idaho's gross domestic product from $51 billion to $60 billion. It is a statewide initiative involving state agencies, our education system, and our business leaders. Designed in 3 tiers to strengthen both rural and urban communities, the plan will create quality Idaho jobs by fostering systemic growth, recruiting new companies to Idaho, and selling Idaho's trade and investment opportunities to the world. While our country's current economic slide has created real financial hardships for thousands of Idaho citizens, it has also created a significant pool of extremely skilled workers who can immediately provide bottom line value to any new or existing business. Our first line of defense is to support those workers that have been impacted by layoffs. A top priority involves making Idaho's businesses and business climate more attractive by cultivating a highly skilled workforce, establishing a method to get research being conducted at our universities and research institutions and commercial enterprises to the consumer market, and improving our transportation and information infrastructure. To grow our existing Idaho businesses, we need to attract and grow a highly skilled innovation workforce, and we're talking engineers and advanced specialties in this case. Idaho needs to establish a centralized tech transfer and commercialization function to get research from our universities, the National Laboratory, and new and orphan technologies from our commercial enterprises to the marketplace. Idaho is known for creating more patents per capita than any other state, but commercialization of these ideas from our creative minds is not happening. It's time to reverse that trend and start building companies from within. But domestically, commerce will build on our recent recruitment successes, specifically targeting firms that will work well with our existing industries. And those include energy, recreational technology, manufacturing, aeronautics, and technology in general. Our marketing efforts reach internationally, not only selling Idaho's products to the world, but also selling Idaho as a great place for foreign sources of capital to invest their dollars. We plan to market Idaho for potential foreign direct investment, or FDI, by targeting specific markets like Canada, Asia, and Mexico. Currently, we are establishing an Idaho EB-5 immigrant investor program to encourage the development of tech transfer and support our entrepreneurial community. Working together with the private and public sector as partners, these 3 tiers of Project 60 will ensure that Idaho overcomes the current economic crisis and emerges stronger for the benefit of all Idahoans. I'd like to share with you some commerce accomplishments during these past 24 months. With our economic partners, the department has played a key role in placing a number of high-paying new businesses within the state. And some of these companies are yet to start their employment cycle, so we do have some positives out there as well. Hoku Scientific, Peterson Inc., and Nordic Wind Power in Pocatello, Arriva in Bonneville County, RX Elite in Nampa, Biopol Laboratory in Cabela's in Post Falls, Packaging Specialties, Pacific Ethanol, Highline, High Desert Milk, and Dot Foods in Burley. In 2007 and 2008, over 2,600 new jobs were created, and capital investment is expected to exceed $3 billion. Commerce continues to maintain offices to promote trade and investment from Guadalajara, Taipei, and Shanghai. We also maintain significant strategic partnerships in Japan, Korea, Hong Kong, Vietnam, and other Southeast Asian countries. In 2008, Governor Otter has led international trade missions to Mexico, Hong Kong, Macau, Vietnam, and Taiwan. Actual and forecasted sales from these missions exceed $5 million. In support of Project 60, we have directed our trade offices to focus their existing resources on not only trade, but also investment promotion. Currently, the value of Idaho exports remains strongly tied to the semiconductor industry. Despite this fact, in 2008, growth in the paper, ore mining, dairy products, transportation equipment sectors continue to be strong. U.S. Department of Commerce estimates that Idaho exports support more than 38,000 jobs each year. Between the Rural Professional Program, the Idaho GEM Grant Program, and Rural Community Block Grant Program, 1,345 primary wage jobs have been created over the past 3 years. Since 2005, 21 rural development grants have been awarded, creating 899 primary jobs and 504 estimated secondary jobs. Average pay for the jobs created through the Rural Development Grant Program is a little over $14 per hour. In the current economic climate, collections for the dedicated Tourism Marketing Fund are down about 5% after experiencing strong growth in 2007 and early 2008. Advanced bookings, website traffic, and travel guide orders all reflect the weaker economy. However, heavy snowfall should be advantageous to areas with winter recreation. Our spring marketing campaigns will continue to reflect adventures and living concepts and present a strong value message to potential travelers with a more conservative financial outlook. Idaho is preparing to position itself to benefit from the 2010 Winter Olympics hosted by Vancouver, British Columbia. Although we don't anticipate the impact 2002 Olympics had on Idaho citizens and businesses, Idaho products and services will benefit as attention is given to the Games. And I might mention that in February we'll also have the Special Olympics here, which will also provide sort of an unscheduled boost in receipts as well. The Office of Science and Technology has a new name. It is now called the Commercial Innovation Division. This name change speaks to the division's decreased emphasis on the exclusive development of technology for its own sake and the more inclusive application of innovation to traditional industries, as well as expansion, retention, launch, and attraction of companies that produce innovative products and services. The Commercial Innovation Division has worked hand-in-hand with our Business Attraction Group, offering subject matter expertise in our efforts to recruit innovation companies. The division administers a very successful federal grant program for small, innovative companies that range across a variety of traditional and emerging industries. Last year, that program attracted more than $4 million in federal grants to Idaho, and that was on a $100,000 program. The division is playing a critical role in establishing the EB5 Regional Center and is working to create a centralized statewide tech transfer protocol. The Commercial Innovation Division continues to work closely with some of our innovation industries to identify solutions to workforce shortages. And believe it or not, in this environment, we still have some workforce shortages, particularly in that high-tech type area. Because Idaho offers such a magnificent quality of life, all of us at Commerce do consider the ramifications of growth. Promoting quality of life and a higher standard of living are the guiding principles behind the department's mission. To assist in mitigating some of the impacts from growth, the department continues the growth management program that began in 2007. Currently, we're assisting 42 rural cities or towns in 10 counties to deal with growth-related issues. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there is a lot of work ahead of us at the Department of Commerce, but we have a clear vision and a willingness to embrace change to grow our economy as efficiently as possible in these challenging times. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Director. Questions to the committee?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Director. You mentioned that a lot of the companies who have established a presence in Idaho are still planning on coming. Can you give me an update on Arriva and what their plans are with regard to construction and development of that project?
Director.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Geddes. The Arriva project is currently pushing full speed ahead. I believe it was just within the last 10 days they have applied for, made application for their project to the federal government. And I believe at this point that the latest figure I saw, I think they could start as early as, it was supposed to be a two-year licensing process, and so it should put it out about 2011 when they start that process. And at that point, we anticipate somewhere between 750 to 1,000 construction jobs, and then operational by 2014.
Great questions. Representative Ballew, Bill Yu.
Bill Yu. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Dietrich, could you tell me what some of the other states, especially surrounding us, are doing and how much money they're spending in their departments of commerce and what they're doing that's different than what they're doing?
Director. Mr. Chairman, Senator Bill Yu. We have typically, I'm sorry I don't have those actual figures in front of me, but I can tell you that that our budget is on the skinnier side of what our competing states are. Much of our activities are very similar, however. It is a very competitive area to be dealing with. Domestically, it doesn't really matter how much money you're throwing at the process right now. It's a very quiet domestic industry out there. However, internationally, that seems to be the area that that continues to be the fertile ground probably for the next 2 years. And so to put things in perspective, we're all doing roughly the same thing, but we tend to be a little on the tighter side budget-wise. And I'd be happy to provide those numbers. I can produce those numbers for you if you'd like.
Director, what in your opinion is the biggest impeding factor in developing patents into economic reality in our state?
Mr. Chairman, that is a superb question, and to tell you the truth, I think our system is basically broken right now. We have a limited pipeline coming from each of our institutions, first of all, and for those growing institutions, for example, BSU, they've got some great programs that are underway. I think they're well on their way to becoming the research institution that they want to be. However, not all of the processes are currently in place in order to allow that intellectual property free flow to the market to be monetized. And so that's an area that Project 60 has undertaken in full force. We actually are in the process of working with each of the universities and are making actually very good headway in that regard to actually put all of that intellectual property under, at least offer them the opportunity to put that under a single umbrella. That way there's some economies of scale that are actually recognized. The Innovation Council, which will be launched here very shortly, and the governor's reviewing those names today, will actually address the issues that impede the flow of intellectual property out of our universities. And so that is what their initial charge will be, is that as the former Science and Technology Advisory Council is reborn as the Idaho Innovation Council. And so that's underway.
Director, is there a shortage of development money, angel money? Is that an issue too?
I think the answer is yes and no. I think if you talk to the venture capital groups, Mr. Chairman, they'll basically say that capital is circling the globe every day and looking for great opportunities. I think in general there are some shortages of venture capital here in the state. And that is part of what the EB5 regional center establishment is all about. It's in essence, our trade offices feel that we could generate somewhere between $30 and $70 million a year outside of the state legislature, outside of the general fund, in order to basically promote the growth of our entrepreneurial community. And so that's what that is all about. It's basically growing companies from within. And so we are working with our venture capital companies that are here, as well as our technology companies, in order to create the right environment for that to happen.
Thank you. Representative Killen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director, you mentioned that there were, believe it or not, I think you said there are people out there trying to hire people, technical workforce. Do you have any idea how many? Do you have any idea why they're having this problem hiring, and to know what we're saying and what we're doing about.
Director.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Killen, I think the numbers are, you know, in all things considered, they're relatively small compared to what the job losses have been. However, the jobs that tend to go unfilled tend to be engineering-related jobs, I think computer science-related jobs. They are the ones that are more technical, require four-year degrees, and you know, for the most part, all of our computer science grads get snapped up before they graduate, and we simply are not producing enough of them internally. Unfortunately, the companies that have been looking, that I speak to regularly about this very topic, you know, basically said that you know, I'd like to think that we could plug people in immediately, those that have been laid off from Micron or otherwise. They aren't necessarily the right fits, and so they've got very specific job skill sets that these companies are looking for. And so, and I know that labor has been working with these folks as well to try to identify, you know, what those skill sets are. And as these new companies come up, it will require a whole new crop of these very special skill sets that need to be developed. So the universities ultimately hold the key to that, to the extent that we as the Department of Commerce can put additional light on what the job opportunities are within the state. You know, attraction is not entirely out of the question, and I know that attracting bodies in from the outside does not seem like the right solution today, given the number of people that are unemployed within the state. However, as you fill those highly technical positions, it creates a whole new tier of jobs that can now be filled. And so it's important that we keep, you know, allowing those companies to expand, and that tends to be, you know, that the holdup thus far, even when things were running particularly well, the holdup seems to be being able to fill these key positions, which opens up a whole other tier of work that would be applicable to the folks that are unemployed today.
Representative, to North Idaho Legislature in November, Schweitzer Engineering, which is based in Pullman, but attracts Moscow job market, had 170 positions open, and they manufacture high-tech circuit breaker type equipment. So it's technical as well as workforce. The North Idaho Manufacturers Consortium had about 200 jobs open, and those were basically professional technical type jobs, welders, things like that. So there are jobs out there. Senator Fulcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Director. I've heard that since the passage of the Sarbanes-Oxley legislation on the federal level, that in other states, it's had a dramatic negative impact on the availability of venture capital money, the VC money, that their willingness or ability to fund businesses. Do you know if that's had an impact in our state, and if so, to what extent?
Director.
Chairman, Senator Fulcher. I cannot address that honestly. I have not heard that, and I've never had that that sentiment echoed. So I just simply am not aware.
Further questions? Representative
Taylor. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director. I might have missed something in passing, but would you share your thoughts a little more about how you see what's going on in the global economy affecting exports from Idaho? You talked briefly about our position there. Would you amplify that a little bit?
Director.
Chairman, Representative Saylor, the weak dollar has had a tremendous impact on our ability to export. Like I said, we're on still a record pace. I don't know quite what the last quarter is going to be, and we are pretty tied directly to the high tech industry as far as generating our total numbers. However, we have seen a broadening of the type of products that are being exported, which is good news. So that has been the number one impact, I would say, is that clearly our exports are on the rise, and that helps to support a lot of positions here in the state and in companies.
The other thing that that I think is critical, and why this is a very unique period of time, we don't need to sit on our hands and wait for the domestic market to perk back up as far as creating the opportunity to invite new companies in domestically. We've got that opportunity to create investment opportunity for those companies that are abroad. Like I said, about 30% of our pipeline today is international. And we have got quite a few new leads that are sort of working in the international area. We're using our trade offices aggressively today, not just to go after exports, but also to encourage capital investment here in the state. And we, obviously, the weaker dollar has helped to encourage some of those investments. U.S. investments are looking relatively cheap, particularly to those to the Asian related markets. So those are the two areas I would say: investment and exports.
Paul,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up. To make sure I understand what you're saying, you don't seem to feel concerned about what's happening in other economies as creating problems for us in terms of exports in particular.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Saylor, it is clearly one that we've got to keep our eyes on. There was a time, probably 6 months ago, that this was clearly not much of a concern. The Chinese RMB is still expected to improve over the next 6 to 12 months. It tends to be an area that we feel that we can generate some great opportunity in. However, as the global economy starts to slow down, it could potentially have an impact on our imports or our exports. Most of the areas that we're looking at, we're not looking at Europe for the most part as far as additional foreign direct investment. Most everything that we're working on is either Asia, and there's still some opportunities in Canada and Mexico. So we are keeping our sights relatively focused, and so those areas today are not showing us signs of backing away from us immediately. So over the longer term, it could be a problem, but today we're not feeling it.
Further questions? Hearing none, thank you, Director.
Thank you, Chairman.
Our next presenter is Jane Whitmire. And the last time I had any association with the Intermountain Forest Association was at their meeting in Coeur d'Alene, and we got 30 inches of snow that day. I hope your presentation won't have a similar chilling effect.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I can't guarantee that. But I can guarantee that it's not snowing nearly as much here as it was that day in Coeur d'Alene. I believe it was about an inch an hour, and for about 24 hours. It was very lovely, although you didn't have to travel. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jane Whitmire. I'm the Vice President for Idaho Affairs for the Intermountain Forest Association. I am a one-person office here in Boise. Our headquarters is in lovely Coeur d'Alene. They only have 8 feet of snow up there, I think. But we are lucky down here. We just got rid of 7 inches, I believe, this warm weather. Today, I'd like to be cheerful and optimistic, and I will do my best to do that. I have been with my board recently. They were here in town yesterday, and a couple of weeks ago we got together in Coeur d'Alene. And I have to tell you that they are amazingly optimistic given the current operating conditions and the situation that has existed in our forest products business sector over the past 2 years. The collapse of the U.S. housing market and in the industry and related global financial crisis has had a very significant impact, a very significant negative impact on our business sector in Idaho. The annual housing starts, which were running way up and hit about over 2 million by the end of 2005, began a downward trend in between 2005 and 2006 and then 2007. And by the end of 2008, the housing starts were their lowest over a little more than six decades significantly less than 1 million. With weak demand, lumber prices fell about 43% in the 3 years between 2005 and 2008. And here is the nationwide composite lumber charts. I'm going to digress a bit. These data points and the charts that I show you every year come from the Bureau of Business and Economic Affairs, headquartered in Missoula, Montana, and these numbers come from a survey that is conducted in conjunction with the University of Idaho between November and December of 2008. So they're very current numbers. You can see where the composite lumber prices have gone. Lumber prices down significantly in fixed costs with our mills remaining relatively the same and high log prices over those same periods of time. We've seen significant financial stress among our member companies in the milling facilities. The sales volume of Idaho's wood and paper products is estimated for Idaho's primary wood and paper products just about under $1.7 billion, down approximately $170 million from 2007. And here's the graph of that. You can see the reduction between 2006 and 7 and 8. The number of forest sector workers has also declined as mills have struggled to maintain their operating efforts. We've had a lot of mills taking steps to keep their workforce together, and they have gone to some very innovative opportunities for their members, but the situation this year was, in the past year, mid past year, was we did see quite a few mills doing rolling shutdowns, knowing that they would close down for a week or two for what would normally be routine maintenance, and some of them would be alternating shifts in very cool ways to keep their workforce together. And as I said, our folks were working very hard to do that. The total employment was about 13,500 in 2008. That's down about 10%. And here is the information graphically, and it is it was going down pretty substantially. Timber harvest declines were seen across all of Idaho's timber land ownership classes, that being private sector, state, and federal. Idaho's estimated timber harvest volume during 2008 was just a little bit under 1 billion board feet, down 4% from 2007. And private land harvest, including industry and non-industrial private sector land, was about 5% lower during 2007 and again in 2008. The harvest from federal lands was down about 5%, bringing their harvest level to the lowest level since World War II. And this is a graphic explanation of that data also. I'm going to digress just a bit on that. There's a very, very low amount of board feet coming off of the federal lands. And I think that's two wood baskets, the federal, the state, and the private sector. With the lack of availability of federal timber, the burden falls, so to speak, the focus falls on state and private. And when land prices fall, the stumpage rates fall, because mills cannot sell at a price that allows them to purchase them at higher levels, then we see the private sector begin to pull their logs off the market, particularly the non-industrial private sector, who are very, they don't have a lot of contractual relationships with mills. And so the emphasis then begins to really focus on state lands, and we very much appreciate the focus of the Department of Lands on maintaining a timber supply in a sustainable fashion, in a very, very environmentally sensitive way, but also understanding that the mills do need a continuous supply of logs. So we appreciate the focus of this body in making sure that the Department of Lands has what it needs to do its job, as well as the efforts by the Department of Lands to look at and manage their lands in successful ways. The number by the numbers is the next slide. Production of lumber, which is the largest component of Idaho's forest products industry, fell to an estimated 1.6 billion board feet in 2008. That's down from 1.75 the year before. And you can see the sharp decline there between 2005 and 2007. Timber harvest the timber harvest is expressing in board feet, Scribner scale, which is kind of an archaic thing. I attempt to explain it. I'd have to get a real log scale in here to do a good job of that. But the expressed in board feet, the lumber carry is roughly equal to that from 1947 to 1983. After 1983, the timber harvest began to decline while the actual lumber production continued to increase. And that may seem a bit odd, but there were changes in our business sector, which included moving toward computerization, modernization of equipment both in the woods and harvesting the trees, and also improvements in transportation and technology in the mill. And I think many people think that we are not particularly technology-oriented, but we are, and almost all of the mills that I represent here in the state of Idaho have a very, very high-tech. And they move logs very rapidly through them because they have to meet their global competition. So one of the reasons is that we can do this is that we have improved sawmill efficiencies. And in the sawmills have started to incorporate quality control, size control practices. This was back in the 1980s. And improved sawmill technology and computerized process control. The technology used in the mills is such now that we can actually take market data, in other words, what is selling in the market today, input that into the computer, and actually cut what is selling in the market this particular day if we chose to do that. The second factor in the decline of Idaho's plywood industry in the 1980s, a higher proportion of the harvested timber went into Idaho's sawmills. And during that time, many sawmills began to retool to handle smaller diameter logs. And if you've traveled up the highway to the north and gone through Plummer, you'll see a mill there that they're my Stinson member, which is a member of our association. And they don't take logs any bigger than 18 inches in diameter. In fact, they prefer them on the smaller end. And that's what we call the small end. We have a large end and a small end. In 2003, nearly 60% of all the logs processed in Idaho were less than 10 inches in diameter, and that's again measured at the small end. If you've been by the Plummer facility, you look at their log area, and it looks like a bunch of toothpicks out there. But they move those very, very rapidly through their mill, which creates the efficiencies they need to be competitive in today's markets. Some of our mills, such as that one, are processing right down all the way from 6 inches to about 3 2/4 inch. The outlook for 2009, this is where I wish we could be a little bit more optimistic, but I can't be. Housing starts for 2009 are expected to decline even further. And that expectation is that the U.S. and global recession will last through the year 2009. And our Western Wood Products Association economists suggest that it will be 2010, maybe the second end of the second quarter, the middle of the year, this calendar year, before we see any turnaround in our business sector in relation to that. So Idaho wood products manufacturers that were surveyed in the poll were very pessimistic for 2009. About 34% of the survey respondents thought that the operating conditions would worsen, and about 40% expected that there would be no improvement. 27% indicated they expected a decrease in employment, and only 11% expected an increase in employment in our sector. So these are the actual numbers from the survey, and I won't dwell on them because they're not happy. But the reason for, most of the data that I'm presenting to you is coming from the survey that was completed. This particular slide is not. This particular slide comes from one of our member companies, which is very efficient. It's very modern. They're the most modern mill in the whole Pacific Northwest region. They have excellent management. They're very attuned to markets. They do a good job of marketing as well as production. And just to give you an idea of the impact that we are seeing to these mills, I asked them to give me some real numbers, not averages. So this is what you see on the wall here is that the revenues in September for this particular mill we're $23 million, and by December of 08, we're at 10. The shipments of finished product, which is the other end of the business, you see the shipments were down from 51 in September to 29 in December. And that really means that there's not much of a market out there, and that is in direct proportion to the housing construction market in the U.S. Beyond that, the credit crisis of this fall has had very significant impacts on the ability of our companies to handle their operating lines of credit and actually impact. This has been a secondary impact beyond the housing market itself. This particular company president said that the first quarter of 2009 would be very much like December, and that the overall outlook for 2009 is that demand would be about 85% of 2008 levels. So that's about the worst I can tell you. Now I'm going to try and put a little good spin on here. It won't be quite as good as some of perhaps other areas that you might hear about later, but I am with concern about obviously the general economic conditions and market conditions and credit. Raw material availability, and we saw this on the slide last year, remains an issue for us, making sure that there is enough raw product to move off of the land and into the mills, and then enough market to purchase that on the other end. Generally, our focus has been on state timber availability and raw product pricing, and we do still work some on natural forest management, and we do go after those when we can, but it's very difficult. The rural manager concerns, different from the landowner concerns, are that they keep the mills operating, finding markets for their finished product, increases in other costs, health insurance, unemployment insurance, transportation issues and costs, energy and availability of qualified personnel. One of the brightest things in our work that we do for our companies now is the workforce development, because our board is very committed to that process, and we work with the Associated Land Contractors. This last year, we put on a summit on that, because one of the issues that we face is maintaining workforce will come into the mills and out onto the land and work, and that they want to come out and do that. And so, as many of my board members said, we have to look to the future, because we'll still be here. We still grow trees in Idaho. In fact, we grow here very well. And that's our comparative advantage. We're very close to the raw product, and we do a very good job of creating dimensional lumber and plywood. I put this slide in every year because I usually get a question on it if I don't. So, the Canadian Lumber Agreement, basically it's out there. It was the Canadians agreed to limit their exports by province to the U.S. Or collect export taxes without a quantity limit. It's a very complex agreement. In 2007, because of concerns expressed by the U.S. side of this agreement, that there was unfair Canadian usage of the agreement, they went into a formal arbitration. The result of that arbitration, again very complex, resulted in a constraint to the market, but the Canadians are very creative at finding ways to move around that and work their lumber into the market. So we follow this very closely. We have a team dedicated to working on those issues when they come up. It's generally dealt with at the Washington, D.C. level in a nation-to-nation discussions. The good news, and I don't want to ever leave this group without telling some good news. The forest products business in Idaho, as I mentioned, for how they're compared with village, trees grow very well here, and we have good species and we have good managers. Our energy costs tend to be lower, although we have to go further to get to the markets. And the energy costs this year, last year, and we went up on the prices, did significantly constrain our business sector. A very bad spot in the state is the state's timber harvest program and their plans for the future. They have done a complete review of the health of their forest, and they are moving aggressively to address that, as well as to meet the endowment beneficiary requirements, and we applaud the work they're doing. The IFA and the AIC continue to work on these workforce development issues so that we can have a workforce of the future. And they're looking very closely at emerging markets and energy and carbon credits. And the land under conservation initiatives that we have spent quite a bit of time on in the last 2 or 3 years looking at monetization of all forest land assets is something that we will continue to look at and discuss and hold conversations with. Just to close out, here's a, these are the list of the individuals from the universities that collaborate. And we thank the University of Idaho and Montana for continuing their survey efforts each year so we can provide you with the most current information in our market sector. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would stand for questions.
Thank you, Jane. In 2008, it was a sad year for Coeur d'Alene. The last mill in the Coeur d'Alene area closed. I used to be able to sit on my deck and listen to the mill chains clanking, and that's gone. It's sad. Other thing that I would add, at the last NCSI meeting I attended, we had a presentation from the chief economist for Standard & Poor's. He indicated about 800,000 home starts a year, or homes a year, were needed to keep up with just the growth of population, and that we had about $2 million, or 2 million homes in inventory. So, at least short term, that does not sound very good. Questions from the committee? Representative Henderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Whitmire.
Use the mic, please.
Oh. Sorry about that. Ms. Whitmire, you made a statement that intrigued me. I really need the answer on that, but I'm going to have a follow-up. You said that Canadians always seem to find a way into the market. How do they do that? Is that a basis of cost they find their way in?
Ms. Whitmire.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Henderson, not generally. Other than their structure is such that the way that the lumber, the timber is sold in Canada, it's almost all crown timber done by the state. And they have a full employment program, so they tend to sell their standing timber at rates that keep the mills running, which that's not the case in the United States. We have to go after standing timber in a competitive marketplace. I'll give you an example that's probably the easiest to understand. If the agreement says that they can ship a certain number of 2x1s to the United States in a year from a certain province, that would mean without any prefabrication or any other development of that stick of lumber. What they would do then is they would go into another category of the agreement and they would, for instance, drill holes in that 2x4 and ship those in under a different category. That's a sort of creativity that we've seen in the past.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Whitmire. I just wonder if your industry has done some brainstorming about what could be done to lower the cost of lumber used for the construction industry, which is really hurting. I'm going to tell you that the number of legislators up north have visited from time to time, just thinking of wild ideas that might help. For instance, we discovered, to personally my amazement, that the truck drivers that haul logs to the mill, the truck drivers that haul sawn timber to market, pay the highest price for their diesel fuel. And I realize it's a higher price than agricultural products are hauled, I believe. And in my mind, timber grown in Idaho is an agricultural product. It's not a manufactured product. So I just wondered why, if your industry has explored maybe the opportunity to appeal to the legislature to think of that and maybe do an amendment to what they have to pay for diesel. And are there any other things that your industry may suggest to the legislature that could help make you access more markets through a lower cost?
Ms. Whitmire.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Henderson, thank you for that question. We are aware of that discrepancy, and we believe that the forest products business sector should share in economies that are existing for other folks. And I think that in our documents on this that have been submitted to the transportation department and to committee members is to the extent that we have indicate that we've got a level playing field, however that would work out. And so the other part of your question is what could, if I understand it correctly, we'll rephrase it, what can the state of Idaho do to be assisting our business sector? Anything that keeps our operating costs down, both on the land and in the mills, is helpful. Making sure that any regulation that is a state regulation of our business practices on the land are reasonable and cost effective in meeting the protective requirements of the state. And the same goes with the mills. We would ask that any permitting issues with our air quality and water quality would be reasonable and stay reasonable. On the other hand, we do value the assistance that the state is providing through its review of carbon sequestration, biofuels, bioenergy, and we look forward to continuing to work with the state on those issues. We believe that that forest land in particular has a great deal of, that there are a lot of assets that exist on the land besides the trees. And those assets have been provided to the general public free of charge, such as access for hunting and fishing and recreating, water quality benefits, the survival of rare and declining species. A lot of that happens on lands across the state that are private lands. And people value those things, but there's no payment to the landowner. And the landowner across the board will look, whether it's a ranch or a farm or a forest landowner, if they cannot make a living and pay for their land, pay for their operation with a revenue stream of cattle or grain or timber, then we look at what else they can do to monetize those assets. And that may very well include selling it off for development, and that is an issue across the state. So those, the willingness of this group and the larger legislative body to look at those issues of monetization of forest land assets and what those benefits provide to the general population of Idaho is a very helpful thing, and we hope to continue our dialogue on that. And thank you for the opportunity to speak on that.
Further questions?
Mr. Chairman, if there's time for another question.
We probably have time for one more, and I see Representative Roberts behind too, so maybe we'll have two.
This will be quick. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Whitmire. This group of legislators up north who have been brainstorming, we were also rather surprised, maybe because we hadn't paid attention, that the state's 6% sales tax applies to everything used to build a home. And we were surprised that every 2x4, for instance, gets charged an additional 6%, raising the cost of the house, perhaps feeding our general fund nicely. But maybe that, has your industry ever considered suggesting that maybe in this economic times there could be a holiday of charging a sales tax on Idaho-produced lumber?
Swimmer,
Mr. Chairman and Representative Henderson, I would have to take that to my board and have them discuss it.
Representative Roberts.
Just no, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know you're up against a break, but Jane, there was one slide in your presentation that says the reason for producer pessimism, and on the bottom of that, it's the only indication that I'm reading in your presentation about what you think the outlook for timber industry is. 85% of the 08 values, is that the extent of the projection?
Ms. Whitmire.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Roberts, I had hoped that I had embedded in the presentation where the expectations were there. If you need some of the numbers behind that, I'd be happy to provide them. But I think the best way to put this is our producers of lumber and wood products are operating at about 50% capacity. And of that capacity, they can sell into today's market about 50% of what they make. And one cannot do that very long. So I hate to be pessimistic, but that is where we are for a variety of economic and financial reasons.
Mr. Chairman, maybe a follow-up comment, and this is something I probably will ask a lot of presenters, is we are charged, the safety member committee or whatever we are, is charged with projecting the economic revenues to the state of Idaho, both on tax receipts and fees and whatnot. And that's why I'm going to try to get a feel from each one of our presenters about what their industry is doing. That's what this is all about. That's why we do this exercise. If we didn't do that, we wouldn't even need this committee. So that's why I asked, you know, as we move along, I'm going to try to get these industries to pin down what they think their best guess is for the 09 year and 10. So that's why I'm asking the questions.
And Representative Roberts, we asked them for 11 as well. Ms. Whitmire.
Mr. Chairman, and Ms. Roberts, if I could follow up that slide is taken from one individual. And that's that particular individual's view. The rest of the data in here is taken from the survey. So it may have been a bad day.
Thank you. Committee, let's take 10 minutes. Let's be back in our seats at 20 after, and we'll get started with the rest of the presentations.